Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Chodesh Tov. Okay, so I want to do something a little bit different today, and we'll see how this works out. This is something that I personally have become a little bit more interested in over the past year, and I wanted to kind of present to you a new kind of way of reading the pshat of the text that I think will hopefully, as we go into the parshiot of the Mishkan, which can sometimes seem a little tedious and a little boring, let us view them in a bit of a different light. So let me start with the title of my shiur, 50 Terms for Snow. There's a popular claim that started actually amongst linguists that has kind of spread to the broader population that certain tribes of Eskimos or Inuit tribes have 50 different ways of saying what in other languages we only say in one word, i.e. snow. So they have a different word for lightly falling snow, a different word for snow that's good for sledding. And this is kind of this idea that because their culture is so wrapped up in this idea that's so inherently part of their culture, their language reflects that by having many different ways of saying it. Now, this is not an entirely true claim. They don't really have that many words for snow. It's actually that the structure of their language allows for a broader variety by the way they use suffixes. But I think the claim itself and the fact that the claim is popular, as I'm going to show you, is a true claim. And the idea behind the claim intrigued me, that a language and the structure of a language or the variety of different types of vocabulary in a language can reflect the culture that is speaking that language. And as a teacher of Tanakh, I just kept thinking, like, there has to be a way that this idea is reflected in the text that we use and the language that we speak. This idea, you know, was kind of sitting around for a while, and I never did anything with it. And then I came across a book a few months ago, which really kind of sparked my research and my interest in this area. The book, for anyone who finds today interesting and wants to read it, it's kind of fascinating, is called The Secret Life of Pronouns, What Our Words Say About Us, written by James W. Pennebaker, who's a social psychologist, teaches at the University of Texas. And the point of his book was that how you use pronouns, in what variety you use specific pronouns, you know, in what way you use those little linkage words, not the main words, like the nouns and the verbs of a sentence, but the way the structure in which and in the variety in which you use those certain little linkage words, like pronouns, can display a host of things about the speaker: gender, class, age, amount of self-confidence, amount of self-assurance. And the book is fascinating, and he goes through all different types of speakers, public speakers or texts, and shows you how the use of different pronouns. I think in the last political election, they were talking about how much certain politicians use the I versus more objective pronouns. So that idea is one of the ideas that he talks about. And the truth is, the idea that kind of little teeny words and what you say and how you use them can reflect broader things about the speaker is something that we're very familiar with in the Tanakh world, because as we know, the whole concept of Midrash is this idea of the focus on the omni-significance of the text, right? That every little letter has broader significance than just the letter itself. That words can have, the way words are linked, can have broader significance, can have multitudes of meanings. That's the whole nature of the Midrashic world. If you're familiar with the famous Midrash where Moshe goes forward in history and sees Rabbi Akiva attaching the crowns to the letters, that he was expounding even on Kotso Shoyud, that the Bet of Breshit can have 50 different meanings. So the idea of significance of small words is something that we're very familiar with. And we're very familiar with the idea that the words themselves, aside from the broader message that's being relayed in the sentence that you're saying, the words themselves can have significance. And let me start off here with a piece that I really loved from Dr. Susan Handelman, who's an English professor at Bar-Ilan. And this is source number one. She kind of expounds on this idea when she talks about rabbinic texts. And she says that if you compare the Greek word for word and the Hebrew word for word, you can see this difference displayed. Because the Greek term for word is onama. It's a name. It's just a way of representing something or referencing something. But its Hebrew counterpart is davar. meaning a word is a davar, dibur. It's not just something you say, but it's something that has a deeper and more significant meaning. So if anyone's familiar with, you know, let's say, the idea of Plato's forms, this is a very ancient Greek idea that the messages that you give are just messages. They're just ways of representing what it is I'm doing. I am going to pick up a dozen eggs at the store tomorrow is telling you something. I could say the exact same thing using different words. I'll be driving to ShopRite tomorrow to buy 12 eggs. You're saying the same thing. The words themselves don't matter. It's the message, it's the name, it's what it represents. As opposed to what we're familiar with in terms of the idea of midrash or the way we read text, that it's not just the overall message coming out of what you're saying, but every single word can have broader significance. We could not have said the same thing in different words. That's the whole idea of midrash, and when we expound on the idea of midrash. So this is something that I want to look at a little bit today. Now, you know, this is not something I'm going to go into more detail, but the idea of the Pshat movement was building on this Greek idea and saying, well, before we jump into the significant meanings of every single word, commentators like Radak and Ibn Ezra said, well, first let's start with what the general meaning of the text is before we get into the deeper meaning. And that's the really almost the separation between onama and davar, the separation almost between pshat and drash. I think can almost be paralleled to that. So let's start with that for a moment. The growth of over the past two decades of what's called the literary theological method of reading Tanakh, something that is really is Torah coming out of the Gush, really espoused by Rav Elchanan Samet, Rav Yonatan Grossman. Their idea was a way, their way of looking at Tanakh is a way of trying to combine these two things and saying, it's almost like this neo-pshat concept, this idea that we can look at just the pshat, just the prose itself, just the structure of the text, the words being used, the syntax, the poetic devices that are being used, and come up with, before we go into the midrash, before we go into the significance of every single letter, we can come up with a way of reading pshat where the pshat itself gives over a message that is more than just the message, i.e. combining the two approaches. So for instance, alliteration would be a great example of this. If you understand that if you can find alliteration in the text, right, then what we're saying is you couldn't have said this message using any other words. You couldn't have said that, you know, going to the store to buy 12 eggs is the same thing as driving to ShopRite to buy a dozen eggs. You needed these specific words because of the alliteration. But on the other hand, you're still just using the surface of the text without going into the midrash. So what I was really fascinated by this, and then kind of combining all of these introductory elements, what if we can look at text just on the surface level, just on the words being used, just on the variety of vocabulary? Do we have a 50 words for snow, in Tanakh, a variety of different types of words that are being used, certain types of literary devices, ways that we can read just the language of the text before jumping into the omni-significance of the text, where the language itself projects a message that is more than just the representative message of the text itself? So if that sounds a little complicated, I'm going to run us through a few examples, and most specifically a fascinating representative paradigm of this that occurs throughout Sefer Shemot, and that I think will help us look at the idea of the Mishkan as well. Okay, so before we do this, I need a few more minutes of introduction just to feel like I'm doing justice to this idea. And what I'm really going to focus on today is something that I started calling amongst my students communication-aimed patterns, which is patterns in the text that are trying to communicate a message that is more than just the actual pshat of what the message is. So let me start with the following. We're going to use Sefer Shemot as an example for that. Language is an imperfect tool. That's number one where we have to start. I think Aristotle was credited with saying that the tongue has never been an efficient servant of the intelligence. What does that mean? The tongue has never been an efficient servant of the intelligence. No matter how expressive I am, no matter how great my vocabulary is, certain things are non-communicative through normal language. Let me give you two examples. Number one is just the idea of the flaws that are inherent in different languages, some things that are simply more easily communicative in some languages than in others. So my favorite example of this is from a linguist named Guy Deutscher, who pointed out that in English, if I tell you, I was with a friend last night, that's all you know, I was with a friend last night. But if you say that in other languages, I am automatically giving over more information than what I give over in English. You'll know if the friend was male or female. You'll know what type of night it was, depending on what word I used. You'll know where we were hanging out, depending what word I used for hanging out. So he talks a lot about this in his books, Deutscher, and it's really fascinating. The idea that the language that you speak, we can say the same thing in two different languages, but my communication can be very limited in one language and much more expressive in another language. The fact that English doesn't refer to objects as a gender in the way, let's say, Hebrew or other languages do is a huge source of his research. Another fascinating example that he discusses that I just want to share with you, and don't worry, this broad intro will all kind of come into the book in a moment. If I say to you, it was hot in Austin yesterday. So in English, it was hot in Austin yesterday. But you don't know if I know that because I was in Austin or because I saw it in the newspaper that it was hot in Austin. In certain languages, English doesn't differentiate, but in certain languages, the way I say hot or the way I say I was will tell you if I know this through experience or if I know it because I read it in the paper. So this is something that is one very important point to understand going into this language discussion, which is languages are limited by their own constraints and their own structures. Number two major limitation of language, and no language is perfect. English expresses certain things that other languages don't. This is just kind of an example of the imperfection or the limitation of any language. Number two, no matter how expressive I am, and no matter how broad my vocabulary is, and no matter if I am speaking a language where everything is as specific as possible, on an emotional level, very often language cannot convey a true experience. And I think this is something that we all have experience with. If I come and tell you a close relative of mine is sick, so you might see from the way I'm talking about it, or if you know that relative, you might feel that what it is that I am feeling. But if I come to you and say, oh, so-and-so's third cousin's child is sick, let's say some Tehillim, we're not, even if I use the most expressive language I can to tell you about the sickness, you're not going to feel it in the same way as if I say the exact same words of a close relative of mine is sick or someone you know, because your relationship to that person is so much more removed. So I can use the exact same words, but I'm not going to conjure up the exact same feelings. And actually, Pennebaker talks about this, and he talks about the difference between dynamic writing and categorical writing, where in dynamic writing, if you use much more you use many, many more verbs, or you use certain types of pronouns. You can actually, they've done studies on this, you can actually pull more emotion out of your speakers, because I could say the exact same thing to you as I'm saying about something else, but you don't emotionally feel it the same way. So with all this in mind, and understanding that language can never fully express every single aspect of a given reality, either because my language can't do it or because I can't express to you the emotion underlying that language, I think we can, first of all, begin to understand what it was Nevi'im were so afraid of. When the Navi says, classic examples of Moshe or Yirmiyahu, when they said, I don't want to do this, and take a look at source 3, because actually, you can really fully almost understand some of the Perushim upon Moshe's excuse of Lo ish devarim anochi, I am not a man of words. So on a very, very simple level, we assume that that means, the Midrash tells us that he had a stutter or he had some sort of speaking disability. But, some Perushim come and say, well, he was no longer familiar with the Egyptian language. But I think it's fascinating that the Malbim at the bottom, so the Sforno actually says that he didn't feel like he had a good vocabulary, that he was expressive enough to do this political job that he needed to do. But the Malbim fascinatingly says, Hanavi shehu shaliach al ha'am ulamdam ulahanigam tzarich sheyeh ba'al lashon v'dover tzchok be'inyan sheyichnesu devarav ba'aznei ha'am. He was fully aware of the limitations of language. He is scared to death that he needs to approach a people who may have no cognizant ability to really understand what he's talking about, no relationship with their God anymore, and teach them religion and history and promises. And Moshe's fully aware that the limitations of language are not going to allow him to do this in the perfect way. He's never going to fully make them understand what God is, how much he loves them, how much history is tied in. And actually, Aviva Zornberg discusses this a lot in her Particulars of Rapture, where she says, any translation is a betrayal, and she talks about the idea that this is what This is what Moshe was afraid of, verbal falsehood. I can't truly represent the situation through speech. Speech can never truly represent a full emotion or a full thought. And that is what he was afraid of. Okay, so with all of that, then, we're looking at the following few ideas. Language is limited, but often the language that I use in its limitations in message conveyance can play a very strong role depending on how I'm conveying that message. And that's part of Moshe's fear. Can I convey it in the most perfect way possible? Can I find the most perfect words to use? So, with Shemot being a major theme in Shemot is obviously communication. Moshe, as the first Navi, you know, really speaking to the people, and the first leader trying to breach the gap between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and people, and trying to do that through communication, his communication, political communication with Paro at the beginning of the book, and obviously Bnei Yisrael as an Am receiving their first communal communication. So the whole idea of just language and communication and how that's expressed is very much tied up in the Sefer. And with that very broad introduction, let me tie in some ideas from Shemot that will kind of reflect this. Okay, so let's start with the following. Very simple example. We'll do a broader example, and then I'll do an example that I think radiates throughout Sefer Shemot. So a very simple example. Hebrew language, Lashon HaKodesh, has a plural you. So this sometimes comes up very interestingly, because in English I say you, and it can mean you in plural or you in singular. But Hebrew differentiates between those two. So if you start noticing in Tanakh where the plural you is used versus where the singular you is used, you can come up with some really interesting kind of communication-aimed language that's being used. And often the plural you is not only used to speak to the plural, it's used in different ways. And you could say, well, why does the language here want to connote a sense of plural when it seems that there's a conversation between two single people? This is something that could never really be expressed fully in English, but can be expressed in Hebrew. So that's kind of a basic idea number one. Basic idea number two, which I found interesting, and we'll try to expand on this a bit, is the idea that in Sefer Shemot, I started realizing there are a very broad number of if-then clauses. If you count up the amount of im, such and such and such, if you do certain things, then certain things will happen, you find that most of them in Tanakh actually appear in Sefer Shemot. So let me give you a few examples. If you look at source number 5 on the top of page 3, first of all, it obviously appears in a halachic element. Im shamoa tishma l'kol Hashem lokecha v'hayashar v'einav ta'aseh, if you keep all the mitzvot, etc., etc., then kol ha'machal asher samti mitzrayim lo asim alecha. We're also familiar with the famous one from Shema. That appears in Devarim. But here I wanted to give you two sources from Shemot. You see the if-then language appearing a lot when it comes to Moshe's conversations with Paro. Im ma'ena tala shalayach ba'otcha machazipam, etc., etc. If you refuse or if you don't. Now, this didn't have to be expressed in this type of language of if-then clauses. You could say, I'll go to the store tomorrow and buy 12 eggs. Or you could say, if I go to the store tomorrow, I will buy 12 eggs. Now, there's a huge difference between absolute language, which includes words like never, always, impossible, etc., versus conditional language. Sefer Shemot has about 12 examples of conditional language. Why? Well, what's interesting is that conditional language places limits or conditions on the statements of facts, which allows the reader's mind to stay open to other ways of understanding the situation. It could be this, or it could be that. So rather than using declarative or absolute language, conditional terms include most, maybe, often, perhaps, likely. And by reading things in conditional terms, you can actually think about other situations. Maybe I won't do this situation. Maybe she won't go to the store tomorrow. So contained within the language of the book, I think this is fascinating, is the culture of free will, which is a huge theme in Sefer Shemot. The idea of you're allowed to consider other factors, non-declarative language, but non-declarative language, but conditional language. And what's really interesting is that in theological doctrines, in different theological doctrines, there are doctrines of conditional security, for God versus eternal security. And a fascinating difference sometimes between Judaism and Christianity is that Judaism relies much more on conditional security. How does one attain, you know, Olam Haba or salvation? If you do this, you will gain this. And Christianity has a whole bunch of ideas that depend much more on absolute salvation. That man is totally, you know, in a certain place that he can never pull himself out of, and God has to come save him and give him salvation without man contributing anything. So I find fascinating that in Shemot we have all this language that points to conditional security. That if you want my protection, this is what you must do. Schar va'onesh, to gain schar. You know, there are actions that are dependent on you, and you have the ability to think about other situations and other ways and then make the right choice. This idea of conditional salvation. So here, this is one broad example, the idea of all the if-then clauses that take place in Sefer Shemot. But let me bring you into what I think is the most basic and ubiquitous throughout Sefer Shemot example. To do this, we're going to rely on a term called a lexical field or a semantic field, which is when in any given book or collection of literature, it's kind of a technical term in linguistics that's used to describe a set of words grouped by meaning to a specific object. So I could say, oh, this chapter has a lexical field of color because the author keeps using all different types of colors. Or, you know, this is a lexical field of culinary terms because the book is full of metaphors that refer to cooking. So we call it a lexical field when in an amount of space, there are a lot of words that tie into one language pattern. So this is actually where you start to get a real sense of a language, i.e. the Eskimo example. They have 50 words for snow, and in one paragraph they might say three different words for snow and use snow in three different metaphors. So you really get a sense from the lexical fields that languages use, a bit of a culture of the language. Or you ask the question, why is this lexical field being used extensively here? And this idea of like a semantic field or a lexical field really, I think, has a lot of communication factors in it, because you can read it and then ask the question, why are we using these words extensively? How are we using the surface structure of the language here to get across a certain message? So the greatest example of this, of like a lexical field that can express a culture, is one that I came across by chance. When I was reading through the pshat of Perek Hay, in a very little metaphor towards the end, and that little metaphor kind of blew up for me and really kind of started detailing the entire sefer. So if you take a look at the end of Shemot, this is when Moshe and Aaron are leaving the presence of Paro. They were just unsuccessful in convincing Paro that he should allow the Jews to leave. And not only were they unsuccessful, but they actually exacerbated the situation, and Paro decides, now I'm no longer going to give you straw, but you still have to come up with the same amount of bricks. Not in a very good mood right now. They come out and they're met by the Zakenim and the leaders of Am Yisrael, who come to them and they say, what did you do? So if you take a look at Pasuk Chaf, Vayivku at Moshe bet Aaron, Nitzavim lekratam, Betzeitam me'ei Paro, this is in Source 6. They say, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should judge you. We can't believe what you just did. Hivashtem et Rechenu be'enei Paro ube'enei Avadav. Hivashtem et Rechenu. You have made us smell bad. You have given us a rotten smell. Be'enei Paro, in the eyes of Paro, ube'enei Avadav, and in the eyes of his servants. So here's what's interesting here. What's interesting here is that this is a mixed metaphor. And the reason it's a mixed metaphor is because you made us smell bad in the noses of Paro. You made us smell bad in the eyes of Paro. Doesn't really make sense. You are mixing your metaphors here. And when two or more metaphors are jumbled together, we usually say that these comparisons are mixed. What fascinated me about this specifically mixed metaphor was that it was a mixed metaphor that made use of the same lexical field. They're both senses. Hivashtem et rechinu be'enei paro. And in fact, hivashtem is the closest English word is almost like savor. It's a smell that also associates taste. So in one little metaphor, and you could have used any metaphor, you made paro hate us like, etc., etc. But instead, the metaphor that's used is a cross-sensory metaphor that touches on three different senses in one metaphor. In one metaphor. Again, anything could have been used for hate, disgust, disapproval, but instead we're using this metaphor. Now, the classic way that we interpret metaphors is that metaphors are used to make something feel more alive. But I specifically want to focus on why this metaphor, and what I really want to look at for the next 20 minutes is the use of the lexical field of the five senses within Sefer Shemot, within the book of Shemot. Because when I started asking why specifically use a triple cross-sensory metaphor, I started realizing that these are all over. So take a look at source number 7. This is a classic one. V'chol et Matan Torah. V'chol ha'am ro'im et ha'kolot. They saw the sounds. So again, on a very basic level, it's showing you that the sounds themselves were so vibrant and so sensory that they saw them. But again, using in one expression, evoking two different senses. And this making it incredibly tangible. And sight and vision are really everywhere throughout the Sefer, both in the use of mixed metaphors, as well as just all over the Sefer itself. So, and this is specific to Sefer Shemot, because if you look in Source 8, in Sefer Dvarim, Vayidaber Hashem Aleicha Mitocha Eish, Kol Dvarim Atem Shomim, Utmuna Enchem Ro'im Zulati Kol. Here we're very specific to separate the cross sensories. You saw what you saw, and you heard the voice. So it's really specific to Sefer Shemot that we're using these, like, let's put in as many different, you know, senses as we can into one metaphor. So you really see sight and vision all over. You see it in Kriya Yamsuf, Source 9. You see it right away when Moshe says, I need to see this vision. This is the first time a Navi is given a vision along with the things that he hears. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov heard things from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They weren't also given vision. Moshe is the first Navi that's actually introduced to vision as well. So you see vision there too. And of course, Matan Torah itself, what they saw, Kriyat Yamsuf says that they actually saw by Yeru what was going on. You could see that at the top of page 4, just one other example. So sight and vision are kind of everywhere. But I want to focus on a moment on this idea of the cross-sensory metaphor and build it from there. Robert Alter calls Har Sinai a tremendous synesthetic experience. Synesthesia, which comes from the ancient Greek together and sensation, is a neurological condition. If anyone read Oliver Sacks's books, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, he talks a lot about synesthesia. And it's a neurological condition which stimulation of one sensory pathway leads to automatic involuntary experience in another sensory pathway. So some examples they give is that people see numbers as colors. And they're kind of feeling through different ways. So cross-sensory metaphors are often described as synesthetic. So a loud shirt, a bitter wind, a prickly laugh. Now, this idea I find fascinating. The idea that one expression can evoke two senses, and what you're really doing is making the most use of the metaphor and the most use of the senses that you possibly can. And this idea of Sefer Shemot striving to use the surface language, the surface structure of their language and its metaphors, and just in the way it tells its story, to evoke as many senses as you can. When I started reading through just the pshat of Sefer Shemot, it is everywhere. And it is everywhere, and it is not necessarily everywhere in other Sfarim. I told you, this is kind of specific. You don't see Devarim describing the exact same event, but describing it in that way. You see that in Shemot. So let me show you a few of these examples. Source number 10, the palpability of the Makot. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Hashem tells Moshe, stretch your hand out, bring Choshech. And the specific words that were used is V'yamesh HaChoshech. What type of Choshech was it? A darkness that could be felt. It was a palpable makkah. Again, there's like this cross-sensory issue. It wasn't just darkness that they couldn't see. It was a darkness. This is where the Midrash jumps in and says that they were paralyzed because it was a darkness that could actually be felt. And that's kind of a description in the Makot. That's kind of one example. And the palpability of the Makot in some places is actually very obvious. They were things that were felt. But here we're using sensory descriptions in ways that you don't necessarily have to. Here, sight is really the only sensory description you need to use, but no, we're also going to use touch as well. Source 11, the descriptions of the Makot, where we're told exactly what it tasted like, the texture and the taste of the water at Marah. There are so many examples of the taste sense as it's used in Sefer Shemot, where it's not used as expressively in other locations. And perhaps the greatest example of all are the descriptions of the Mishkan, where the Mishkan itself, if you read it through, notice as you're reading them in the next few weeks, how much the descriptions engage all five senses. The smell of the ketoret, what the bell sounded like, the texture of the curtains, the heightened color, the color descriptions that are used, the types of textures of the woods that are described. There is not a single sense that is not evoked by the description that is inherent in the Mishkan. So this is example number one of the lexical field of tangibility. Shemot, in its very descriptions, in the metaphors it uses, in the way it describes normal things that don't have to be described that way, evokes the senses. That's number one. But there are two other examples that speak to the lexical field of tangibility. Number one, an idea that is very central to Sefer Shemot, is that this book contains and almost more anthropomorphisms and anthropopathisms central to Sefer Shemot than in any other book, by which I mean describing HaKadosh Baruch Hu as touchable or as tangible. An anthropomorphism is when you apply human descriptions to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so Yad Hashem, for instance, and obviously there's a lot of philosophical discussion back and forth between whether or not we can really do this, whole other topic, but Sefer Shemot, anthropomorphisms are more central to this book than any other book. Anthropopathisms are when we describe human emotion to God. God is angry, God is sad, so that would be pathos from the term emotion. There are more of these in Sefer Shemot than any other Sefer. So, for instance, the idea of Yad Hashem is all over Sefer Shemot, Yad Chazakaz, Rohan Etuyah, pulling them out. So source 12 shows you a lot of these examples. We're very familiar with those. Yad Chazakaz and Rohan Etuyah is used over 15 times just in Sefer Shemot. You don't see that phrase used more than a couple other times anywhere else in Tanakh. Really only in Shemot and in Devarim when it refers to Yetziyat Mitzrayim do we refer to body parts of God so often. Etzba Elokim Hi is a great example. How do even the non-Jews talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu? They're using this anthropomorphism as well. Natita Yemincha, etc. These examples are all over Sefer Shemot and are specific to Sefer Shemot. So what I find fascinating about this is that, again, this lexical field of tangibility. Everything is touchable. Even a Kadosh Baruch Hu, who we don't usually like to use these terms so much, Sefer Shemot, we use those terms more than anything else. Emotions are characteristics being displayed in sensory form. Vayichazek Hashem et lev Paro. Paro was stubborn. How do we say Paro was stubborn? His heart became hard. You could see these sources in 13. Rigishei Hashem, kind of the emotions of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Achazek et libo. Hardness language appears close to 20 times between chapters 4 and 10 of Shemot. Doesn't really appear that often anywhere else in Tanakh. Stubborn, as Kshei Oref. That they're an Am Kishay Oref, that an emotion is being displayed in a sensory form all around Chet HaEgel, and the only time Devarim refers to it in that way is if it's referencing Chet HaEgel. This I thought was great. Peret Chaf Pasuk He, also at the bottom of Source 13. Jealousy is Kel Kana, which is actually related to the Arabic word kana'a, to become dark or intensely red, that we call Hashem kel kana. The verb indicates the visible effects of the emotion on one's face. Taking emotions, making them sensory, making them visible. This, to me, is a fascinating way of looking at the language structure of Sefer Shemot. This lexical field of tangibility. It's different than a mila mincha, or a late word, a word that appears very often, or a repeated motif. What this is showing you how the linguistic patterns themselves, where you didn't have to say it in that way, but you said it in that way to represent a certain type of direction of communication, the internal message of the language. So what is that message? Taking a look at this lexical field of tangibility, that the senses are evoked so often in Sefer Shemot in ways that are not really done so in other situations and in ways that you don't need to, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is almost made touchable in Sefer Shemot, that emotions are made tangible and sensory in Sefer Shemot. Why would that be? What would be the communication that is being used through these language patterns? And I think that we can look at this at a number of levels. Number one, as we said, translation is difficult. Using language to get a point across, to express an emotion, to express a feeling, to express anything in any language is difficult. That was Moshe's fear, according to Aviva Zornberg. And this idea that translation can never do a perfect job. Some things are really hard to understand and can't be expressed linguistically. Therefore, the words we use are going to be the linguistic basis to what it is that you feel and what it is that you sense. So this is a fascinating topic that I could go on for forever, but for instance, and this I just threw on there because I think it's pretty fascinating. For those of you who've read Orwell's 1984, so he in this dystopian world that he's talking about, the government of this world created something called Newspeak, where nobody in the world was allowed to speak anything but Newspeak. And the fascinating part of Newspeak was that they took words out from the language that they didn't want the people to be able to talk about. So they took out the word freedom or independence, and the goal of doing that was that if people could not speak those words, the concept itself couldn't exist. And they've actually done, you know, research about this in Soviet Russia, how as things left, let's say, for example, as certain foods were taken off grocery shelves and they just became, people could no longer have access to those foods, they found that as years passed, people no longer use the word, and the word for that food fell out of use. As a simple example, that language itself can shape our relationship to those concepts, or even our cognizance that those concepts exist. And Orwell talks a lot about that, that it was designed not to extend, but to diminish the range of thought. You can think about things less if you don't have a word for them in your language. Maybe in the way that we actually think about snow in a much less complex level, because we don't have 50 different words for 50 different types of snow. There would be crimes and errors which would be beyond someone's power to commit, simply because they were nameless and therefore unimaginable. So therefore, what's my point? That we use our words, and the way we use our words are meant to give us an understanding of something broader, and a concept that's contained within the language. So if we look at that then I find it fascinating that Sefer Shemot uses tangibility as its lexical field. Because we're very familiar with the fact that we have a chiyuv on Pesach to feel as if we ourselves had left Mitzrayim. And if we're given that responsibility and we're told you need to feel it, well then the language and the text itself is doing its best to let you touch it and to let you feel it and to let you sense, using all five senses and using HaKadosh Baruch Hu as present as they can, what that moment was like. And I was thinking how fascinating that was, just in parallel to what Rav Goldbeck was talking about this morning. He was talking about how the very similar idea, we can't fully imagine it, so we have to use our powers of Dimyon to feel what it was like. Well, we can combine it's almost like the psukim themselves, the Sefer itself, is helping us imagine by making the story as touchable and as tangible as possible. And to me, that, if we tie it kind of back to the beginning of Susan Handelman's idea of Davar versus Onoma, so before we even get to the beautifully complex and sophisticated world of Midrash, what every yud means, just the structure of the language itself couldn't have been said in any other way. Just the way that it's said and the descriptions that are used are meant to do something for us and are meant to give us that. And then kind of as, this is an idea, kind of the linguistic usage that communicates something, a communication-based pattern, is something that, as I was kind of looking over the last few months, I really came across a fascinating piece from a molecular biology report in Source 16, where the writers of the piece were making the case that scientific prose should be changed to use more tangible vocabulary, and that people would be more interested in science if the words they used weren't so dull. And one of the things they said is, prose in particular can modify an unsuspecting reader's physiological and emotional states profoundly. The semantic priming test in modern psychology exploits this phenomenon. For example, people start to feel and behave as though they have suddenly grown older after they have read a scrambled sequence of words enriched with age-related connotations. So the idea that a text that has certain types of prose or certain literary patterns in it can become visible and can have an actual visible effect on you is something that I found very interesting. And at the end they said, we suggest that apparently cognitively bleak biomedical texts can and should be transformed into perceptually richer prose. And I love that phrase because I think that's what you see throughout Sefer Shemot, this perceptually rich prose by relying on this type of language. So again, it's how you're stitching the text together in terms of its communicative sense and the power that you're using there. And we all know that when it comes to Yetziat Mitzrayim, and we have this strong command to remember, well, memory is evoked by ritual and recital. Reading the Torah and Shul is an act of recital. Acting out Yetziat Mitzrayim on the night of the Seder, which we do, is an act of ritual. And what I love is that the text ties the two together. We recite something, but we recite something that also speaks to the way that we behave. It can affect our behavior and allow us to relive it. And it's the nature of what we're experiencing. And the linguistic theme of Sefer Shemot, of this reliance and this dependence and tangibility, is that the language is in this experiential ritual in and of itself. So as we are kind of smack in the middle of Sefer Shemot here and approaching Pesach soon, I think it's something really interesting to keep in mind when you're reading through when you're reading through Parsha, or you're just reading through the Pshat text. And I think this is kind of really one way of fascinatingly understanding Pshat, that it's not just the message itself. The Pshat of "I'm going to pick up a dozen eggs" is the message itself, and if I want to keep true to Pshat, I could say it in any other way. This denies that idea and says you can't say it in any other way. The way that it's expressed and the way that it's said is important. Now, we're not even at the Midrash level, which absolutely is based on that idea, but the way things are said and the language that we use and the linguistic patterns that we use can very much be an expression of what it is that we're trying to say on a deeper level than just the message itself. And with that, I wish you all a Chodesh Tov and a wonderful reading of the end of the Parshiyot of Sefer Shemot.